Good evening. My name is Charles Goodhart, and I'm Deputy Director of the Financial Markets Group. Now, it's a very unusual privilege to be able to introduce our director to his own school. Nevertheless, it's entirely appropriate that his first formal lecture here is to a group, the London Financial Regulation Seminar, which focuses on exactly these issues. For Howard has been the key person in the United Kingdom dealing with these issues for the last 9 years. First as Deputy Governor of the Bank of England for a couple of years, and then since 1997 as the first, indeed the founding father of the FSA, the Financial Services Authority. But he's done very much else besides in his brilliant career. Indeed, so many that I have to turn to read them out because I wouldn't remember them all. He started in the Foreign Office, went on to be Private Secretary to our Ambassador in Paris, then went to the Treasury in 76-82, on to McKinsey & Co., then back to be the Special Advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1985-86, then became the Comptroller of the Audit Commission, then the Director General of the CBI, until he moved on to be Deputy Governor of the Bank of England. If, however, at this stage, you are getting jealous of him, you should also remember that he is an avid supporter of the Barnes Common Cricket Club and the Manchester City Football Club supporters. And that means that he should have all our deepest sympathies, particularly just at this moment. Finally, I hope that you all saw his Financial Times article this morning, which indicates that he is, as I hope he will continue to do, continue to work in this particular field. And he is going to be addressing us this evening on the subject of creating a single financial market in Europe. What do we mean? Director.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, for that introduction. I expected to see you as a Charlton Athletic fan in a black tie this evening. As you have lost your best player to another Russian rush of cash to Chelsea. But this is, in fact, as Charles suggested, the first time I've delivered a substantial lecture to the school since I arrived, and it is also the first time I have talked about financial regulation, particularly financial regulation in Europe, since I left the FSA, and therefore in a state in which now, after a decent few months' distance, I am now liberated from the constraints under which I operated at the FSA. I should say, however, that not everything I say this evening will be different from what I said at the FSA, because it may surprise you, but occasionally I actually did believe what I was required to say when I was chairman of that organisation. However, as I hope you will notice as I go through, not always, because a little bit of distance and a little bit of reflection on particularly the processes of European regulation, which I'm talking about this evening, does cause one to take perhaps a slightly different view of some of them. Now, I think it's important when talking about the single financial market to see it in its context. And the context is that European heads of government committed themselves at the Lisbon summit in March of 2000 to the objective of making the European Union the most competitive economy in the world by 2010. And one crucial policy strand which is supposed to contribute to that glorious objective is the creation of a capital market in Europe which can rival the North American market in terms of its depth, its liquidity, and its flexibility. The aim is to develop a market which allows European companies to raise finance on competitive terms, to promote investment and growth, and which provides investment opportunities across the continent which better match the needs of all European investors. Now, in general, I think we would have to acknowledge that progress towards the headline objective of making Europe the world's most competitive economy has been, over that four-year period, to put it politely, slow. Productivity growth has continued to lag the US, rates of business formation are still slower, and unemployment in continental Europe, at least, or most of it, remains stubbornly high. Perhaps we are making progress, but if so, it looks to be a case of, as we say in English, reculer pour mieux sauter. But that is not to say that the whole of the Lisbon agenda has stalled. And in the case of the building blocks of the single financial market, many of them have been put in place. I suspect, however, that the heads of government in Lisbon, could you go back to them now, would be somewhat surprised by the way in which their initiative had in practice been taken forward. At the outset, the Single Financial Market Project was seen as a flagship project for the UK and for, let us say in shorthand, the market liberals in Europe generally. It was intended as an initiative to remove barriers to financial market activity across the continent and to create freedom for the investment banks in the City of London to spread happiness and joy across the continent. But as is the way in the construction of Europe, the process of defining what was meant in practice by the single financial market was handed over to the European Commission, which devised the Financial Services Action Plan. And the FSAP consists of 42 directives or regulations, many of them of impenetrable detail. Taken together, they introduce a significantly more intrusive and costly regulatory regime for many financial firms across the EU. Just one example will suffice: the Insurance Mediation Directive, which was intended to allow cross-border insurance broking throughout the EU, introduces a regime of regulation of all insurance brokers, even if purely domestic in their business, in order to create a level playing field for cross-border activity. The result is that some 20,000 new firms will be brought into the FSA's regulatory regime, with, in my view, highly doubtful benefits from the point of view of the policyholder. Costs will rise, and the consumer detriment in general insurance is not sufficiently large to justify these costs. Consumers can easily check the costs of house or motor insurance policies very quickly, get competing quotes, and press on. The regulatory regime already provides some assurance about the prudential soundness of firms allowed to offer this business, and it's not by any means clear to me that any sensible cost-benefit analysis would tell you that you needed a regulatory regime to intermediate between the broker and the policyholder. Now, that is just one example, and I could quote you others, and indeed perhaps the most visible example has been in relation to the Investment Services Directive, where interesting disputes have arisen. And as a result of this detailed articulation of the action plan, interestingly, the lineup of support for the FSAP has somewhat shifted. And it's now quite common for the UK government to find itself in a minority of states resisting the terms of new financial market directives. And that is currently true, for example, in relation to the Investment Services Directive, where the UK was voted down last October on some crucial points, which we may come on to later. So the first major question I would address this evening is, how has this happened? How has a liberalising initiative become bogged down in detailed negotiations? And how is it that the country that was most supportive of the initiative at the outset is now facing difficulties with its practical implementation? Now, in my view, a good part of the reason for this turnaround derives from a lack of clarity about the objectives of the single financial market programme right at the outset, and indeed in a lack of understanding of the different positions of different member states. Now, we all understand, I think, if we observe European policy, why agreements on the reform of the common agricultural policy are so difficult to achieve. For some countries, the agricultural sector is a far more significant part of the economy than it is for others. And indeed, the same is true of financial services. The UK is in a particularly strong position and is, if you like, a natural exporter of financial services to the rest of the Union. It therefore has an understandable interest in lowering barriers to exports and indeed in lowering barriers to takeovers. We are quite used to hostile takeovers and to the creation of large multinational financial conglomerates. And I think many people in the City of London would also proceed on the basis that if financial market activity were allowed to gravitate to the most competitive centre, then London would almost inevitably be the major winner, because there is, as we know for a variety of reasons, a strong winner-takes-all phenomenon, particularly operating in wholesale markets. By contrast, those countries which are sizable importers of financial services tend to fear that their financial sector might be wholly taken over by foreign companies which have quite a different set of interests. And they are likely to look for rules which, in practice, make it difficult for overseas institutions to establish a dominant participation in their market. And we saw an intriguing example of that arise in relation to the Prospectus Directive, where the UK and a number of other like-minded countries thought that the Prospectus Directive would mean that a company that wanted to raise money would be able to take its prospectus and go and register that prospectus in whichever market seemed most likely to deliver it the kind of investor base that it wanted. Whereas the other countries said, no, what this means is that a company must register with their home authority, and then with the registration from their home authority, then maybe they can seek capital elsewhere. But effectively, this had the impact of repatriating business that had gone elsewhere. Eventually, a kind of compromise was achieved whereby if you're looking for bond finance, you can actually go wherever you like, but if you're looking for equity finance, you have to go back home. There is no logic in this. And eventually, I'm sure that will have to be changed. But it was an interesting example of the completely opposite way in which different countries who were neither natural exporters or natural importers saw what was essentially originally conceived as a kind of liberalising measure. There are also significant differences in the character of financial regulation from one country to another. In many continental European countries, for example, financial regulation focuses on the product. There are tight definitions of the kinds of product you can sell, of the types of investments that may be sold, of the types of investments that you may have within a product wrapper, including detailed rules about their risk characteristics. Process regulation, by contrast, in continental Europe typically, is far less well developed. In the UK, broadly, the opposite is true. We have typically eschewed product regulation on the grounds that consumer interests are best served by the flexibility and innovation you get if you allow people to sell what they want unless they're not allowed to, if you see what I mean, rather than the other way around. But we recognise that some of the imaginative products that will thereby be promoted will be quite unsuitable to unsophisticated investors. So there are serious disciplines in our regulatory regime on the selling process and particularly on advice. These are fundamentally different ways of handling particularly retail regulation. And it is extremely difficult to get either side to agree to adopt the other. We tend to sell process regulation, but of course, anyone knowledgeable about our retail market will say, why should we buy this idea when it has delivered you pensions mis-selling, split capital, investment trusts, endowment mortgages, etc. To which we somewhat uncomfortably say, well, nonetheless, the counterfactual might conceivably have been worse. Though sometimes I used to find it quite hard to describe just precisely how it would have been worse. But these naturally different positions, I think, were little appreciated at the beginning of this programme. And very little analysis was done of the way in which different countries' regimes had developed and therefore of the problems that there would be in trying to bring them together into a common framework. But beyond that, there was, as I say, a crucial lack of clarity about the objectives. UK policymakers typically thought of the programme as one designed to facilitate capital raising across the Union. It was a part of the competitiveness and liberalisation agenda of Lisbon, and therefore the big interest was in lowering the cost of capital for investment and growth. Elsewhere, the programme was seen as one which focused just as much, if not more, on retail investment. And that was not surprising, because with the introduction of the euro, that was a natural focus for policymakers in the eurozone. They were quite reasonably concerned about the growth of cross-border trade in financial services, even in the retail sector. For the out countries, retail rulemaking seemed a lower priority, indeed one which could bring considerable cost with few observable benefits. And at the same time, there was no clear understanding about the nature of the regulatory regime that would be necessary in a single financial market. Now here, I will simplify heroically, but let me say that there are, I think, two generic approaches to regulation in a single market: mutual recognition or harmonisation. Now, anyone expert in the field, and I sadly note there are a few people in that category in the audience tonight, will tell you that there is, in a sense, a spectrum between these two. But let me try to simplifies and say that mutual recognition means broadly what it says. It means that you accept broadly different regimes in different countries, recognize the validity of different regulatory structures, and, so to speak, taking in each other's washing. And that is, broadly speaking, the approach taken in many other areas of European regulation, and indeed it is the approach on which international financial regulation outside Europe is built. In Europe, in other areas, the Commission sets general rules and relies on member states to police them in their own countries, and we assume, broadly speaking, that they're policed in a comparable way. Harmonisation is rather different. It implies that we should be looking not to recognise each other's regimes, but to establish one single rulebook for the whole of the Union. Now, of course, a certain degree of harmonisation can be compatible with mutual recognition. Indeed, the UK government's line has typically been to argue for mutual recognition based on a set of harmonised core principles. So, to give some reality to that, for example, I think in the UK, and the FSA would accept that it's very helpful at European level to have one definition of what we mean by a retail investor, because otherwise it is quite difficult to market products across border if the definition of a retail investor is significantly different from country to country. On the other hand, we have tended to argue that you don't need a completely standardized disclosure obligation, because that might be different in different countries depending on the nature of the product and the sophistication of investors, etc. That has been the approach we have tended to argue for, but many other countries go much further than that. And the harmonizers can be subdivided into two categories, the maximum harmonizers and the minimum harmonizers. Now, I recognize that at this point we may be getting into a big-ender, little-ender dispute. And for those not familiar with SWIFT, those who believe it appropriate to eat a boiled egg from the big end go to war against those who believe it right to start from the little end. But the difference between maximum and minimum harmonisation is rather more significant. Minimum harmonisers tend to argue that there are certain rules which ought to be common across the Union, but that we can, as I've suggested, allow some flexibility to reflect the nature of the different markets in different member states. The maximum harmonisers take a different view. They believe you should harmonise everything to prevent member states engaging in strategies of competitive deregulation, or indeed to prevent the addition of super-equivalent measures domestically, which might have the effect of protecting home companies from cross-border competition. Increasingly, the Commission has been putting forward maximum harmonisation proposals recently, which are inevitably more detailed and more constraining, and usually more costly, especially for those countries like the UK, which already have well-developed regulatory regimes, which then need to be significantly changed following the passage of a maximum harmonisation directive. The third area in which there was a lack of clarity at the outset concerned the way a single financial market would be regulated. At its simplest, would there be a single central regulator, or would member states themselves be responsible? Here again, the UK government's position has been straightforward. The UK sees no reason to depart from the usual arrangements in Europe, whereby rules are set centrally but are policed locally. Others, however, have argued that we will not see a fully functioning single financial market unless there is a single regulator, or perhaps a set of sectorally based regulators in Brussels or another continental financial centre. So it's perhaps not surprising that as these uncertainties were left unresolved at the outset, the process of articulating the rules for a single financial market has been fraught with difficulty, because versions of these underlying arguments have arisen on many of the individual directives, and ad hoc solutions have been reached in each case, leaving a complicated patchwork of rules and regulations, which do, in my view, lack some clarity and consistency. However, it is fair to acknowledge the Commission have nonetheless made considerable progress with the FSAP. Many of the 42 measures have now been enacted, certainly over 30 of them, or are close to completion. The Commission have overcome inertia and some political obstacles, so it will be possible for the Commission to declare some sort of victory in 2005, which was the target end date for the completion of the market. But as we approach that date, it is reasonable to ask ourselves just what has been achieved and what the practical effects will be. My assessment, I think, can only be cursory tonight, but now that I have moved to an academic institution, I feel less embarrassed about offering a partial assessment, because the flip side of that coin is that more research work is necessary to produce a clear and comprehensive assessment of the FSAP, and I'm sure the LSE would be happy to perform such an assessment for a suitable consideration. But it's possible, as I suggest, to draw up a preliminary balance sheet, and to do so, we can usefully consider five linked tests. As I said this, I seem to recall the five-test framework being used elsewhere, but the precise reference escapes me for the moment. The first test is whether we are making adequate progress with the legal and regulatory framework. The second is whether that framework is actually being implemented and enforced evenly across the EU. The third, and obviously linked question, is whether we have adequate and compatible regulatory structures across the Union to promote enforcement and broadly comparable application of the rules. The fourth is whether our financial markets and institutions are in practice operating in a way which will mean that the opportunities created by the single financial market are taken up. And the fifth and last is, if you like, an overall assessment. Are there signs that the programme is in practice delivering more cross-border financial activity, more competition, and keener prices? Now, the first test, the rules, on that, I think we can say that more than three quarters of the measures in the FSAP have been implemented, though not all quite in the form envisaged. Some, for example, the takeover directive, although strictly speaking that wasn't part of the FSAP, have left a lot to be desired. And others, such as the investment services directive, remain embroiled in difficult negotiations. Indeed, one major piece of the jigsaw, the risk-based capital directive, awaits the conclusion of the Basel II exercise, which is rather like waiting for Godot. But overall, we would have to acknowledge that in its basic rulemaking task, the Commission has done reasonably well against a tight deadline. This, of course, says nothing about the content of the directives agreed. It's too soon then to produce a definitive verdict on this first of my five tests, but so far so good might be a reasonable summary of the position. I expect there will be some slippage in the original timetable, but I doubt whether that will be crucial. But there is, of course, another question which the Commission will need shortly to address. What happens beyond the existing FSAP? Is there a need for an FSAP 2, another raft of harmonising legislation? My own view is that the Commission should be very cautious in proposing more legislation in the short term. There are perhaps some areas in which further progress is needed, particularly in the insurance and especially reinsurance markets, but the Commission needs to take account of the digestive capacity of the market, and that would suggest to me that any further activity of a legislative kind should be very carefully considered and very tightly focused. Indeed, my view is the Commission should adjust its focus away from legislative productivity and towards implementation and enforcement, which is the subject of my second test. Are the single financial market rules being enforced? Now, it's much harder to give a definitive answer to that question, but my judgment would be that we are still a long way from consistent enforcement. In part, that is because of the unrealistic timetables for implementation of the directives which have been set. Some of the changes required are extremely complex and require a major overhaul of the domestic regimes. It is highly unlikely that all the directives that have recently been passed will be implemented on their planned timetable. My successor at the FSA has indeed made the point forcibly that a huge amount of change is emerging all at the same time, and that firms are finding great difficulty in coping with it. There is also, frankly, evidence that in some countries, companies continue to stumble on obstacles which stand in the way of cross-border activity. In some cases, they are required to establish local presences where that should not be necessary. They're required to seek local approvals where they ought not to be required. And there are sometimes tax and other reasons which create domestic preference. To some extent, the remedies for this lie in the hands of the market itself. Companies need to be ready to bring complaints to the Commission, and so far, relatively few have done so. But the pan-European networks of regulators also have a role to play. One of the aims of the Lamfalussy reforms, on which I'll say a little more later, is to forge a consistent approach to regulatory action across the EU. So far, not a lot has been done in that area, but there are plans afoot. On the second test, therefore, the verdict can at present only be must try harder. Implementation and enforcement are still a problem. The third test leads on from this point, and it is, are the regulatory structures in place. And this, in a way, is the most controversial area at the moment. There are those, as I've said, who argue that we will never see a proper single financial market unless there's a single regulator, and that the regulatory structures in Europe are simply not compatible with the kind of financial integration which heads of government seek. I do not agree with this line. In other parts of economic life in the European Union, we typically agree law and rules at the centre, which are then implemented in member states. We agree rules on cleanliness of beaches, but we do not see inspectors from Brussels in Blackpool, something for which they are no doubt very grateful. It's also crucially relevant that enforcement takes place in the court systems of individual member states. And until we have a single legal system, which, should I say, looks a little way off, enforcement is bound to be local. So I am not a supporter of a Euro FSA, and certainly not of a Euro SEC. On the other hand, we do need to recognise that financial services are in some ways different from other forms of economic activity. That is why we have agreed a framework of mutual recognition so that if a UK resident places a deposit in a French bank, she must look to the French Banking Commission for reassurance and protection, not to the FSA. And if that mutual recognition system is to work effectively, we need to have proper confidence in each other's work. And that, in turn, does require a greater degree of commonality of approach in regulation than is necessary in some areas, though it does not amount to the case for a single regulator. There needs to be more joint working and more collaboration on rulemaking and enforcement than is typically the case in other areas of economic life. And that is the argument for the new Lamfalussy committees of regulators, which ministers at last, just a couple of weeks ago, finally agreed formally to establish. I might say, in parenthesis, that it took European finance ministers 18 months from the decision to establish these committees to agree the location of the tiny secretariats of the three, which amount to maybe three or four people in each case. The chances of them being able to agree on the location of a single regulator in less than a couple of decades must therefore be remote. But if we are to have greater collaboration between regulators, it would certainly help if those regulators were similarly structured in different member states. Indeed, that is a point which the Lamfalussy Committee made in its report, which has been given less prominence subsequently. Are there any signs of convergence in Europe on a common model? Until recently, it would have been hard to answer that question in the affirmative. But there are now signs that regulatory integration is finding favour in more and more member states, albeit not always exactly on the same model. There are now single regulators in Sweden, Denmark, the UK, of course, Germany, Austria, Ireland, and Belgium. Considerable integration has been achieved in the Netherlands, Finland, and in Luxembourg, and is under discussion elsewhere. And one outcome of the Parmalat affair in Italy looks likely to be some regulatory consolidation there also. Unfortunately, we are still some way short of consensus, and a number of countries, notably France, remain attached to a three-pillar structure with banking supervision still in the central bank. Indeed, on this crucial point of international financial policy, the French and the Americans stand shoulder to shoulder. It's nice that on that they agree, if on nothing else. In fact, however, the activities of the central banks in Europe, in my view, have been quite difficult from the point of view of regulatory consolidation. Indeed, the European Central Bank has set back the cause of regulatory consolidation in Europe with its own claims for a central role in banking supervision. In my view, it's inconceivable that ministers would wish to give the ECB, with its deliberately high degree of independence, entirely appropriate for monetary policy, the responsibility for major areas of financial regulation. And I think that under Jean-Claude Trichet, it's unlikely that the ECB will continue to press for regulatory powers. My own view, which I know remains highly controversial in some parts of Europe, is that the case for integrated regulation has now been so strongly made out that other countries should move quickly towards it, both on the grounds of domestic effectiveness and in order to facilitate the European collaboration we need to make the single financial market work well. Unfortunately, a number of central banks remain to be convinced of that. So for the time being, we have to say that we do not have regulatory systems in place which would give us the best chance of completing the single financial market, and there is still considerable work to be done. The fourth test gets us closer to what is going on in the market itself, and that is, are the markets and institutional structures in the private sector beginning to develop on a pan-European basis. Now, for the moment, I think we would have to say that there is relatively little sign that financial services firms themselves are gearing up to exploit the potential of the single market. Now, there are some exceptions to that, but I think overall that is true. If we look solely at the banking sector, a recent study has shown that of 19 major banking mergers in the last 5 years, only 7 were cross-border within the European Union, and most of those were relatively smaller deals. The most obvious trend has remained continued consolidation within member states, instanced by the BNP Paribas deal in France and the Royal Bank of Scotland's acquisition of NatWest in the UK. A number of other potential cross-border mergers in Europe, which might well make economic sense, have foundered either on the unwillingness of authorities to sanction such deals, not in the case of the UK, I should add, or national sensitivities about head offices and cost-cutting. Several banks have attempted to pursue the goal of a pan-European retail bank, but have so far been thwarted in those ambitions. It's not proved possible, for example, to buy a sizable bank in Italy, given the Bank of Italy's resistance. As a result, I have met many bank chairmen who would like to establish a pan-European institution, but who would like to be the second chairman to try it, not the first. There has been some cross-border activity in the insurance market, but again, not on a scale which is likely to revolutionise the provision of financial services in the Union. In the securities market area, we are, of course, all aware of the high-profile failure of the proposed Frankfurt and London exchange merger. Euronext has, by contrast, made considerable progress in bringing a number of European exchanges closer together from France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and now Portugal. Albeit the business model remains somewhat short of a single multi-country platform. But the tortoise rather than the hare approach to exchange consolidation seems to be more successful at the moment. I remain of the view that further consolidation of trading platforms in Europe is likely to occur in the next few years. There are something like 25 equity markets still in the current EU, compared to 3 or 4 in the US for a much larger overall market. So my conclusion here can't be particularly favourable. There is still a long way to go, and the market is certainly not telling us that conditions for pan-European provision of services are in place. Which brings me to my fifth and final test, whether the market is responding in terms of cross-border activity and whether that is producing the supposed benefits of a deeper and more liquid financial market, both for investors and capital raisers. It is frustrating to note that there is relatively little hard evidence on this question, and one which one might reasonably think which was the most significant issue we face. Some attempts have been made to assess the potential impact of a single market, but I do not find them wholly persuasive or adequately rigorous. One is left, therefore, with an impressionistic response to the question. I think there are different answers for the wholesale and retail markets, respectively. In the wholesale markets, there is evidence of growing consolidation of activity in a small number of centres, notably but not exclusively in London. Most of the investment banks operating in the EU have centred their activities here, and that applies both to American-owned and continental European-owned institutions. Most sizable cross-border M&A activity in the EU is handled in London one way or another, as are most major capital raisings. The potential investor base, which can be accessed here, is very large. But there is also some evidence of consolidation elsewhere in the community. German and Eastern European business have tended to move towards Frankfurt, for example. These trends have, however, been underway for some time, and it would be hard to attribute them directly to the Financial Services Action Plan. The FSAP does simplify legal and regulatory processes to some degree, but my suspicion is that if you looked at a long-term trend, it would be hard to see any discontinuity in the general direction of consolidation of wholesale market business, and attribute that to the action plan itself or any particular directive within it. If we look at cross-border banking, the picture is very patchy. One interesting measure is the total assets of branches of banks from European Economic Area countries in each individual European country. So, for example, in the UK, the total assets of European headquartered non-UK banks in London in 2001 was around 1.4 trillion euros, which is about 25% of the assets of the UK banking system as a whole. That, you might say, seems to show quite a highly developed degree of cross-border business and European integration. But the total assets of all other European banks in the branches in all other European countries, excluding their own, in which they operate, was only 650 billion euros, just under half the total in the UK. So fully two-thirds of the cross-border activity in bank branches is taking place in London. The picture is slightly different if you look at subsidiaries, where the numbers are larger in other countries, but that partially shows that banks have been obliged to operate through domestically capitalised institutions rather than on a straightforward cross-border basis, and that means a less efficient use of capital. In the retail market, we have to acknowledge that the amount of genuine cross-border business is relatively small in spite of the introduction of the euro. Though it may be reasonably said that we are looking at an early snapshot and that cross-border euro business may well begin to grow. The picture varies from sub-sector to sub-sector. The UCITS directives have stimulated some cross-border selling of mutual funds, but there's very little cross-border retail banking so far, in spite of the initial promise of internet banking. The one high-profile internet bank launch in the UK, which was based in a bank which was actually owned in Ireland but with a banking license in France, First E, has closed down. And there's been relatively little in the way of cross-border life insurance or pension business. That may be partly attributable to regulatory obstacles, but also to different tax regimes and different structures of long-term saving. In many cases, they have cultural roots and are not likely to be altered in the short term by regulatory change. It remains the case that retail markets are very different across the Union. In some countries, almost all retail transactions are handled by the customer's home bank. In the UK, of course, few people look for long-term savings products to their banks. Also, the UK's dual system of tied and independent advice is not widely operated elsewhere in the Union. And the coverage of private sector pensions products differs hugely from place to place by a factor of 5 or 6 from the largest to the smallest market penetration. So we are a very long way from a single financial market for European consumers, and my suspicion is that regulatory harmonisation in itself is unlikely to deliver that single market. There will be a need for more pan-European firms and for changes in tax and social security systems, which are probably more significant obstacles. Now, this may seem a somewhat downbeat assessment of progress, and in a sense it is. I believe that some of the aspirations of politicians in this area will take a considerable time to be achieved. Furthermore, a lot of effort is underway to reconcile the details of regulatory regimes, particularly in the retail markets, which I suspect will have little impact on consumer behaviour, yet will impose significant costs on firms. I believe the FSAP has focused far too much attention on the retail sector, where in the short run the scope for beneficial integration is relatively small. I also believe that in some cases the wholesale market initiatives have been misconceived. There is not time this evening to look in detail at individual measures, but in its current state, the Investment Services Directive may hinder the development of efficient capital markets in Europe, rather than encouraging them, by placing restrictions on the extent to which investment banks can internalise customer orders, and indeed restrictions on the provision of execution-only broking services. But what my assessment shows most strongly, I think, is that the next phase of activity in Europe needs to have a different focus. We need less new legislation and more effort on practical implementation. The Commission needs to spend more time on enforcement, crucially with the help of industry itself. There needs to be more analysis of just what the barriers to cross-border mergers and acquisitions and to cross-border selling really are. Many of them are nothing to do with the detail of conduct of business regulation. Some of them are barriers imposed for straightforwardly protectionist reasons in some member states. And in individual countries, they need to tidy up their domestic regulatory systems before making grand plans at the European level. The arrival of a new commission later this year would be a good moment for reflection on this programme. The frenetic regulatory activity of the last 2 or 3 years has been driven by a perceived need to meet a political timetable, and one ordained, in my view, without heads of government having a good understanding of what it was they wished for. The new commission would do well to pause for breath, to allow the directives already agreed to settle down, and perhaps to ask again the question of what elements of financial market convergence will genuinely promote economic growth and prosperity. If they ask themselves the question in that form, then I doubt whether the Insurance Mediation Directive, or indeed the proposed Consumer Credit Directive, which would impose quite an unsuitable structure of harmonised regulation across the Union, would score highly on any rational assessment. So my final plea is for the new single market commissioner, whoever he or she turns out to be, to pause for breath and have another look at precisely where we are going in trying to achieve this single financial market. I have no difficulty with the endpoint and the objective, but I think the process has become embedded in detail in a way which is risks being counterproductive. Thank you.
So Howard has agreed to answer questions. If you want to ask a question, could you please give your name and affiliation when you do so? And there are roving microphones. Wait for the microphone. There we are. It's coming. It's there.
Christopher Johnson, The City in Europe. I choose that particular affiliation as being the most relevant one, if not the most glamorous. I'd like to ask you how much difference you think that the existence of the euro has made to the creation of a single financial market. It so happens that most of the countries we're talking about as being laggards have the euro. Does this not help by, for example, encouraging the quotation of equities all in the same currency, or is it simply there in the background and doesn't really make much difference to the other factors which slow things down?
In the development of the single market directives, the euro has had remarkably little impact. And it is certainly true to say that in the discussions between regulators in Europe, in which I have spent too much of my life in the last few years, the euro itself has not been at issue. I mean, it is very rarely discussed because the single market rules apply to the whole of the European Union and not to the eurozone. However, as I briefly alluded in the early part of my speech, the euro has created somewhat different priorities in different member states. And so there is an underlying tension generated by a division between ins and outs, which does not appear at the level of the negotiation of the directives, but it does have an impact on the priorities which different governments have. Because I think it's fair to say that in this country, the prospect of significant cross-border selling of retail financial products seems to most of us, and certainly to Treasury ministers, to be somewhat remote. I mean, there are a tiny number of people like me who have a euro account, and an even tinier number who have a euro-denominated mortgage, but most people are still reasonably put off by the prospect of exchange rate volatility, and the chances of this developing in any very significant way, in my view, are quite small. In other countries, they do think that could easily happen. And therefore, they are more interested in setting out detailed pan-European rules on retail selling, which we think to be an extremely low priority, because we already have a well-articulated regime, and having to change it to one which is inevitably different and possibly even less effective seems like a really poor way of spending your time. Whereas if you are a euro, particularly if you're a small eurozone member, you are concerned that you may find a large chunk of your market going to highly competitive institutions across a border, and therefore you do want to be sure that there is a common regulatory regime. So it's an underlying tension, but not an explicit one.
There.
Kevin James from the Financial Markets Group. To use the less sensitive affiliation. the amount of effort that's gone into creating the single European market has been enormous, not only in terms of the amount of regulatory effort on behalf of firms, but also in the point of view of the opportunity cost of the regulatory regime and the Treasury and various people. Since the payoff has been so small, based on your talk, I was wondering if you thought it might be better for the UK to focus on limiting the damage from European regulations to the greatest extent possible and focus instead on creating a single an official market in one country, namely this country.
Yes.
but we don't have that option, really. And one of the slightly depressing things that I found, we found at the FSA, was that the UK's impact on the development of the programme was somewhat reduced by the fact that most of our large institutions, for quite some time, didn't pay any attention to this. And indeed, I well remember a conversation which I had with actually David Green, who's sitting there from the FSA, where we talked to one of our largest institutions about 2 or 3 years ago and said, you know, it would be really helpful if you could up your game in lobbying in Europe, because most of the lobbying in London seems to come from the US investment banks, and you know, that doesn't always the best lobbying to have from London. And they said to us, oh, we don't really have an interest in this because we have very little business in continental Europe. And we went back saying, you know, but just a minute, all of these rules will have to be applied here. Oh. And a lot of our institutions were very slow to appreciate that even if they were purely domestic, that they would find themselves having to alter their business models as a result of European regulation. So, you're right that, you know, one could have, the payoff might have been better focusing on a domestic regime in the UK, where we have a rather well-developed one. But that is not an option, because these rules will apply, they will dominate the UK rules when directives are implemented. And therefore, you simply have to do the best you can, and you have to try your hardest to engage at the right point and to try to argue the case for a regime which you hope will be rational and based on an appropriate cost-benefit analysis, and therefore will be as useful as you can make it. One of the frustrations and actually quite considerable difficulties that the FSA has is that in the domestic regime, after a very lengthy debate in Parliament and a lot of effort in lobbying by financial firms, the regime which surrounds the FSA's own rulemaking is quite a rigorous one, and it requires you to produce a competition analysis of anything you do. It requires you to produce a cost-benefit analysis. It requires you to publish that. It requires you to take account of the views of a practitioner panel and a consumer panel, and if they disagree with what you want to do, you have to produce a reasoned response. And all of this articulation of a framework within which you must deliver a regulatory regime. And most of that is quite absent in the development of European directives. So we have the curious position where for the sort of small part of the market where the FSA is entitled to produce domestic regime, you have an incredibly elaborate process of disciplined cost-benefit analysis. And then a European directive can come and overturn all of your regime, about which no cost-benefit analysis is done whatsoever. And yet it dominates the domestic rulemaking. So, you know, what you suggest would have been nice, and sometimes I thought that would have been pleasant to have been able to proceed in that way, but that's not the option we have.
McVie from the Department of Accounting and Finance here at LSE. One of the things that has been often commented on in relation to retail financial services here is the very low level of sophistication of the average consumer and the need for education in that regard, which I think there have been recent government initiatives on, and indeed the FSA has supported them. Do you have any perception as to the level of financial sophistication of consumers elsewhere in Europe, and is there a role for the European institutions in developing education in that regard?
I think it would be difficult to quote any sources, indeed I'm not aware of any, that would allow me to give you an authoritative answer to that question. My speculation, however, is that financial literacy in most other European countries would be not greater than it is here, and possibly even less well developed. But in some ways, that matters less, because in most continental European countries, the financial choices that people have had to make have been much more tightly constrained, in that they have not had the freedom to choose personal pension providers, or if they do, the investment choices of those providers have been very tightly constrained, and all of the paraphernalia of product regulation has meant that the average consumer of financial services in Germany faces a much simpler marketplace of products than is the case in the UK. And if you just compare the mortgage markets, for example, apart from the fact that actually fewer German householders have mortgages anyway, but even if they do, they are very, very much simpler. And whereas here we have 4,000 different mortgages that you can offer with all kinds of weird and wonderful features to them. So we have the biggest problem of consumer education because of the mismatch between the complexity of the product offerings here and the relatively poorly developed consumer understanding of them. And if you just compare, say, the mortgage market of today with the mortgage market of 25 years ago, you and I are old enough to recall that when you got your first mortgage, you went along to the building society and you put yourself in a queue. And when they felt you'd been in that queue long enough, they would graciously offer you a mortgage and you could have anything you liked as long as it was variable rate and 2.5 times your salary. And there was nothing very complicated about it. Now, the range of mortgage choice is inestimably more complex, but nothing systematic has been done between times to try to improve the ability of consumers to make those choices. So I think our problem of financial literacy, on my analysis, is greater than elsewhere in Europe, because our financial market has been allowed to develop in a way which has delivered more complexity. Now, in the end, you can then ask yourself, well, what is better? Which sets of consumers? This is a question which I don't think anyone's really tried to answer. Is have retail investors as a whole in the UK been better served by a regime of greater complexity and competition and diversity and innovation than the consumers in Germany who have faced a much more rigid set of choices? I think if you'd answered that question in the year 2000, you would probably have been able to produce quite a good case for it being the UK consumer, because the UK investor had been able to benefit from a long bull run in the equity market one way or another, and endowment policies looked great, and people who didn't really know that they had exposure to the equity market nonetheless had, and had done very well. In 2003, and even today, it's not so clear. And clearly the endowment mortgage case is an example where a lot of consumers are saying, well, we never knew we had this exposure to equities and we never wanted it in the first place, and now we appear to have lost a lot of money. Since they haven't net lost money, they're just not getting what they thought, but they've also not been saving enough because they had an illusion of what their investments were. But it's a very interesting question, and one which occasionally, late at night in the bar, regulators, when they've done all the tedious bit, debate, and it's very difficult to produce an answer to it. Most people in continental Europe think that they've had the better side of the bargain and that actually a simpler regime has avoided the kinds of mis-selling problems that we've had. I think probably most people in the UK still just about believe that we've had the better side of the bargain, because on the whole more people have been able to benefit from rising equity markets. But it's a tough one to call.
There's a question at the back.
Denton Wildsaft. You mentioned that there were problems with a number of the directives and that they actually came out at a place where you didn't expect that they would. And you specifically referred to internalisation and the Investment Services Directive. Now, a number of those directives are actually framework directives, and there have already been referrals down to CESA to develop the implementation, the implementing measures. To what extent do you think that those level two measures will actually assist in ironing out some of the problems that you've referred to?
Well, I think that they could, as long as the regulators are given time to do that job properly. Because it's fair to say that one thing I didn't have time to develop tonight is the way the CESA framework is operating. And in general, I'm quite optimistic about that, in spite of all of the difficulties there are. But when regulators, practical regulators, get around a table, when they have a consultative group of people from financial markets, which, you know, sometimes even has a few lawyers, I'm going to thought I'd say it, but even lawyers occasionally play quite a constructive role. And it is often possible, given time and care and detail and goodwill and mutual confidence, if you like, to produce, you know, artful solutions to poorly worded legislation. And I guess it's not only in a European context that that has to be done. But at the moment, one of the problems is that because of the very tight implementation deadlines, the CESA consultation process is being short-circuited on occasion, because it simply isn't being allowed the time to, you know, to iron out the difficulties in individual member states. And it's pretty complicated domestically, as we found with the Financial Services and Markets Act, but to do it at 15 different legal regimes and soon 25, you know, is pretty complicated. So another, you know, rather practical and detailed point that I would make would be that we'd have in the end a better outcome if the Commission, having finalised the directive, were to allow the regulators a somewhat more relaxed timetable to work out its detailed implementation in a way that which would do least violence to some of the well-developed systems in individual member states.
The next question is here, but while that question is being asked, I think you better tell some of the audience quite what CESA is.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry about that. CESA is the Committee of European Securities Regulators. Lamfalussy, Baron Lamfalussy, was asked to, with a group of wise men in 2001, to say how should regulatory collaboration in the single market operate. And he said, well, I think what you need is three networks of regulators, a securities one, and, well, he was originally asked about securities, but the strong implication of his work was that this model should be applied elsewhere, and indeed it now has been. And so there's one called CESA, modestly named, the Committee of European Securities Regulators, based in Paris, a Committee of European Banking Supervisors, which is now going to be based in London, and the Committee of European Insurance and Pensions Supervisors, which will be occupational pensions, sorry, which will be based in Frankfurt, which, to my knowledge, is the location of no significant insurance or occupational pension company.
Ian Beck from, dare I say it, the European Institute. Two very brief questions. I understood from your, I think it was test four, that one aspect of test four being passed would be evidence of cross-border banking groups or financial intermediaries growing up. If, and let's speculate on this, Deutsche Bank, you mentioned BNP Paribas, and the Royal Bank of Scotland were to get together in a three-way conglomerate, which national supervisor would you advocate should oversee it? And the second question is, one of the reddest of red lines from this country is no tax harmonization for capital markets. Can we have a single European market for financial services with very disparate taxes, or do we need some form of approximation for it to happen?
The second question is obviously politically very sensitive, but I did say on one or two occasions that I thought that if you genuinely wanted a pan-European market in retail financial services, then there are certainly currently tax obstacles that make that somewhat difficult. In my view, the tax harmonization red line is a bit blunt. I mean, I can perfectly well see the strong government attachment to a lot of domestic tax policy. But I think there are aspects of, for example, the handling of withholding tax, I mean, which is pretty detailed stuff and doesn't really get at the heart of, you know, the sovereign right of determining your tax system, which could, with benefit, be harmonized and make it much easier to handle cross-border regions. So I think that, you know, if you unpick the tax harmonization question and say which bits of it are really about rather detailed things which are not fundamental but which could ease the passage of cross-border financial activity, I think there's things you could do in that area. On the first one, well, it would depend on where its headquarters were and where its mind of management was. And some of the cross-border issues have founded on the fact that companies have not been prepared to be clear about where the company was going to be run from, and have tried to advance structures which would be impossible to supervise in our current regulatory structure, because they muddle up where the actual head office of the organization is. But it's perfectly possible to have a European framework, to have a consolidated supervisor wherever the head office and management of the group is, but nonetheless, of course, to have operating subsidiaries in member states, which as a practical matter can be supervised by local regulators under the auspices of a consolidated supervisor, which of course you would have to have anyway, because there would be very, very few institutions of that scale that would only be EU. And indeed, they would almost all have a US presence and presence outside Europe as well. So you have to have a consolidated supervisor plus local supervisor structure. But there's no reason why even a grand merger of the kind you suggest could not be handled in the existing structure.
Stéphane Collignon from the European Institute. Howard, you mentioned the comparison between German, particularly mortgages, and the variety of products in the UK. One could also say that one of the main distinctions between the continent and the UK economy is the fixed and flexible interest rate contracts on mortgages and other aspects. Do you have any ideas how to explain this? Is it more a demand side determined phenomenon, or is it the supply side one? Is it that British families like to gamble on their houses, or is it and the Germans are very conservative, or is it just the fact that regulation started so much earlier here than in Germany?
Well, I think that there might be two slightly different answers to that question in different parts of the marketplace. I think one answer is, though, that we have tended to have a philosophy of allowing the market to develop products and then regulating the process of sale. And I think that approach goes a long way back. I mean, certainly goes all the way back to Ford, with his philosophy being a relatively hands-off philosophy, but that you should focus on what people were told about products and then allow them to make up their mind and ensure that they were told the right thing and given the right advice, and then it was up to them to make their choice. But it's fair to say that you can't really run that argument specifically in the mortgage market, because in fact, until today, we don't have any regulation of the mortgage market. I mean, we have prudential regulation of banks who offer mortgages, but in fact, there are unregulated mortgage providers even, and the process of designing a mortgage and selling a mortgage is not a regulated activity, even today. It will be soon, end of this year, October of this year, I believe it'll start to be. So that market has developed in a way which I think has developed without the benefits of a regulatory regime to guide it, if you like. As for why people have gone more for variable rate interest rates, well, that is really the subject of the Chancellor's commissioned inquiry by Miles, isn't it? David Miles, who's looking at that at the moment. And I think his preliminary work has suggested some rather complex sets of factors, some of which are producer-driven, that in an era of volatile interest rates, it was more convenient from the bank's point of view, because they were then sort of naturally hedged, if you like. But also, I think consumers, have shown a reluctance to fix rates because somehow perhaps they attach a higher weight to the advantages of the downside rather than the disadvantages of the upside. But it's quite a complex issue, which I think he has found, even in spite of a lengthy review, quite difficult to pin down why our market develops in that way. But I guess the underlying reason has been more volatile interest rates, and therefore banks themselves not being so keen on offering people long-term fixed mortgages, because they would then have to hedge them quite expensively, and they might then actually also be more expensive. In a lower interest rate environment that we have moved into since Bank of England independence, with lower long-term rates, then you have seen a gradual development of the fixed-rate mortgage market. But before then, it was, banks were not enthusiastic about offering them.
I think I must limit the number of additional questions to two. We'll move the next one here. And then, Ruben, you'll be the last question. We can't go on forever, though I'm sure many of us would like to. It is getting a bit late.
Thank you, I'll be brief. Adam Kinsley from the other LSE, London Stock Exchange. An observation and then a question. The observation was in response to the question earlier about fixing the directives through the Level 2 CESA process. From what we've seen, the directives, in fact, aren't high-level principal frameworks, and CESA is being asked to fill in a lot of detail but hasn't got much scope to fix what goes wrong at the Level 1, which is the observation. The question is... I absolutely echo your sentiments about needing more time, not only from the regulator side, but from the market side to just absorb and respond to consultations. We get very frustrated because when we raise these issues with CESA, they say, well, this is the Commission's timetable. When we raise it with the Commission, they say, well, this is the Member States' timetable. And I think you alluded to that it was a perceived timetable. And what I'd like to ask is what your view is on whether the UK government could have done more to slow down the process, and generally whether the UK government has played its hand well in the 30-odd measures so far.
On the first point, I agree with you that the aspiration to determine framework directives has not been carried through. Partly that's to do with the Parliament, I think, which has been keener than our Parliament to get involved in the detail of financial regulation, which is slightly curious in a way. It was quite a debate in our Parliament as to whether the FSA would be given the rulemaking discretion that it was given under the Financial Services and Markets Act, and that was debated in the Burns Committee on our bill and also in the Bill Committee itself. And generally, the view in Parliament here was, look, we can't realistically go through all of this regulation, that it would be almost a bogus form of parliamentary accountability, because you might pretend you were going through it line by line, but you don't really know what it means anyway, and the time you have is just not realistic. And therefore, that Parliament should focus on the framework and the disciplines on the regulator, you know, the principles of good regulation, as they're called in the Act, the cost-benefit requirements, the competition analysis, and all of that, and then give a degree of discretion after that, and then knock you on the head if you've got it wrong. You know, and that is a better thing than the details line by line. The European Parliament has taken a different approach, and it's quite interesting and quite difficult to know why that has been the case, really.
Can I just interject there? Because I think the difference is that in the UK, the regulation is being made by the FSA, who are regulators, whereas in Europe, it's being proposed by the Commission, who aren't regulators. It's not being proposed by CESA. So
yes.
We actually sort of welcome the Parliament intervention because it does give you a chance to correct the Commission's proposals.
Well, the trouble is it's chicken and egg, isn't it? Because if Parliament wants to do that, the Commission then produces more detail. Whereas if it was, you know, if they adopted the framework approach, which was actually what Lamphalisi recommended, and left the detail to be articulated by the regulators in a dialogue with the market, I think that in principle is a better approach, and that's what Alexander Lamphalisi recommended. But somehow the dialogue between the Commission and the Parliament has created greater levels of detail. As for the UK Parliament, I think you asked two questions. One on the details of individual directives and two on the overall timetable. On the detail of the individual directives, I would say that after perhaps a slow start, the government have played not a particularly easy hand, not at all badly. This is a rather backhanded compliment, you might say, but because we are often given the nature of our regime and the particular sort of structural position we find ourselves in financial services markets, often in a natural minority, if you like. And that was why I tried to emphasize at the beginning, you know, the starting points of different countries. And given that, I think that a combination of the Treasury and CREP and the FSA have not done too bad a job. And if you look at the directives, some of the original formulations and what eventually emerged, you can see, you know, a lot of sort of market reality creeping in during that process. The more general question, however, is whether is this issue about the timetable. Here I would take a different view, and I indeed have argued before that this, and it's inherent in my argument tonight, that heads of state wished for something which turned into something else, actually. The FSAP, if you asked them in the middle of the night in Lisbon when they signed up to this, is this what you think you mean, 42 directives? They'd have said, Christ, no, you know, that's not what we think we mean. We thought we were pulling down some barriers. You know, that was the way it was articulated. And I think it would have been far better 2 or 3 years ago to have said, well, our experience of this process now is that this could deliver some jolly good objectives in the long run, but it's complicated. And it's more complicated than we thought, and therefore any reasonable person would say, let us reformulate this objective. You know, far, not stop it or come back from it, but you know, redefine what we're really trying to achieve some early wins on the wholesale side, redefine the retail timetable, push that further out. And that would have been, in my view, preferable to going on with a timetable, which I think has proved increasingly unrealistic, and which won't, in fact, be met in practice anyway. You know, whatever is said about the completion of the single market, we know that as a practical matter, these directives will not be being implemented by many firms around the European Union. And if they're not being implemented effectively here, you can be sure they're not being implemented effectively in some other places.
Last question.
Very briefly, Sir Howard. I want to take up this issue which you responded to the stock exchange person. You started off by saying that there were three reasons why it hasn't delivered what it was hoped for. You identified a lack of clarity of objectives. You identified a lack of understanding on member states, on the part of member states, as to other member states' positions. And you identified a regulatory divergence. And what you didn't identify, and in fact that was one of your successes at the FSA, was blunt realpolitik. And I would like to challenge you to say that a better explanation as to the failure, to the extent that it has failed, and let me not say that it has failed, but let's say to the extent that it's delivered what you've said, which is marginal success, is precisely because of a lack of understanding of hard political objectives, namely states wanted to protect their markets, whatever the case, and whatever the rhetoric at the beginning, it would have been naive to have accepted, it was naive to have accepted that rhetoric at the beginning. This is really supportive of you, but challenging you to take it further.
Well, I don't disagree with that, and indeed at 2 or 3 points I did say, and perhaps if I'd wanted to underline this more firmly as you did, that the natural starting points of the different member states in this area were such as to cause some, notably us, you know, to want as liberalizing approach as quickly as we could, and others to worry about, as the French would put it, delocalization of financial activity. And that sort of tension has been underlying a lot of the arguments about individual directives. And so, yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that analysis.
Well, the real politique is that all good things have to come to an end. And we must end by thanking Sir Howard very, very much for a lovely chair.